This is The Guardian.
Election time, how do you feel about that?
Dread.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Dread.
Hi TikTok, sorry to be breaking into your usual politics-free feed, but I'm making a big announcement today and I've been told that a lot of you already have some views on it. So, first thing, no, I'm not sending everyone off to join the army.
Of the Liberal Democrats, of course, on a paddleboard and in the water. Apparently he fell in 5 times.
Why is Naz Shah, the Labour MP for Bradford, doing a big message, a big shout-out to her voters yesterday in a foreign language?
I think it's more important to stand in front of the electorate and say, I'm sorry, I can't now afford what I said before.
I'm Pippa Creera.
And I'm Kieran Stacey.
You're listening to Politics Weekly Westminster for The Guardian.
Hi, Pippa.
Hello.
So we were sitting in our Westminster office, what is it, a week ago now?
Yeah, almost exactly a week today.
Thinking, oh my God, the election's actually been called. We're going to have to gear up for the next 6 weeks of complete chaos and mayhem. How's the first week been for you?
Well, I'll be honest with you, I still feel slightly shell-shocked because even though we have been planning an impending election for some time, we thought, first of all, it might be in May. And then when that didn't happen, we assumed that it would happen in the autumn. So all our planning, both at work at The Guardian, but also in my own life, has been based on it happening in the autumn. So, you know, suddenly it's like, oh God, got to rip up all my plans and start again.
I wonder whether the parties are in a similar situation, because it's been a slightly weird start to the campaign for a bunch of reasons, which we'll come on and talk about. But one of the things that struck me is that even though, you know, Rishi Sunak called this election, neither party seems to have been quite ready for it to start with a bang. It's kind of almost been a phony first week of the campaign. And maybe that's why we're seeing, you know, gaffes and unscripted moments dominate the agenda a bit more than, you know, it might have done.
It is surprising, though, particularly on the Tory side, when you think that they were apparently, were told, planning this for, you know, at least a month. They knew that this was the date that they wanted, July the 4th, that things aren't smoother. And, you know, today, I think, is a good example of where events have overtaken the script for the Labour Party. Today, Keir Starmer and Wes Streeting made this big announcement fleshing out the details of their NHS waiting list plan to cut a waiting list speedily in the first term of a Labour government. And we've ended up all talking about Diane Abbott, because one of the things, I suppose, about a speedy election is that it's meant that not all the candidates are confirmed in all the seats.
Right.
And Diane Abbott, the veteran Labour MP for Hackney North and Stoke Newington, had been suspended from the party. And in the last couple of days, we have found out that actually she had been told that she had got the whip back. And then there was this report yesterday that suggested that she would not be allowed, she'd be barred from standing again in her seat, which I think was probably not the way the announcement was choreographed to happen. Mm. My understanding is that she'd been given assurances that if she got the party whip back, obviously something she wanted, she'd been a lifelong Labour MP, that she would then be given the freedom to stand down, to announce that she was retiring on her own terms. But I'm also told that her big concern is that there would be people within Labour that wouldn't let this happen, and that somehow it would be characterised as a purge of the left, or, you know, that she'd been forced out. And then lo and behold, there was that briefing last night which suggested that she had been barred, which brings us today and all the questions that Keir Starmer's been facing on his NHS visit.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking about this earlier, and tell me if you disagree. My view is this one incident will get forgotten about. Probably most voters might not know who Diane Abbott is. They certainly won't know the ins and outs of what's been going on over the last year as Labour has undertaken this convoluted, long investigation into one article she wrote for The Observer. But I think it is quite telling, as you say, about the way in which the party is led right now. And Keir Starmer has been accused many times of having a small cabal around him of mainly male. Now, Labour says that's unfair, but there are certainly a lot of youngish men around him who take decisions in private, are not very open about why they're taking those decisions, use them sometimes for factional reasons to kind of beat up the left a little bit, and that this causes massive problems. Now, this was supposed to be solved to a certain extent by bringing in Sue Gray, who's obviously a consummate professional. And one of the things Sue Gray has brought to the Labour leadership is a much greater emphasis on talking on Keir Starmer, talking to his own party, talking to his own MPs and being more sensitive about their concerns. But there is obviously still this tendency within those around the Labour leader to hit out at their own MPs, and that just causes them massive problems.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with much of that, but I also think that probably most voters do know who Diane Abbott is, that she has been a fixture of British politics for decades, and that she represents, like you say, beyond the sort of left-right factionism within the Labour Party, she represents something much bigger, particularly to lots of black voters. Mm. And she became a very sort of loud and proud voice for not just BME voters, but also people who were kind of like, you know, cut out of the system, that had no stake in it, many of them her constituents, but people like her constituents around the country as well. So I think people did know her, and I think that's why in this particular case it's been so problematic for Labour, because they are running into, or they've run headlong into, actually a great deal of affection and in some cases sympathy for the situation that Diane Abbott's in, even though she made remarks which she subsequently has apologised for and had to undergo training. I think actually across the House there was a recognition that, you know, she is a, she's going to be a historical figure, right? Mm. And I think what this has done, though, is yes, it has confirmed the view that some on the left have, that the people around Keir Starmer are more factional than they should be. But it's also raised questions about his own handling of the situation and the fact that today he came out and he denied that Diane Abbott has been banned from standing, you know, desperately trying to backpedal. But I think it's too late. I think the damage has been done. And it was really interesting that the Tories think that they can capitalise on this. And you've got the spectre of Rick Holden, who's the Tory party chairman, writing to Keir Starmer, ostensibly on Diane Abbott's behalf, saying, you know, what's going on? Because they think, they see a spot of weakness here. They see a moment where they can suggest that not just about being in control of what's going on inside his party, but also that this is another example, as they see it, of Starmer changing his mind.
So two things I think that reflect badly on Keir Starmer here, both of which might have consequences during the campaign and in power. One is the overly long time it takes, and maybe it's not his fault on this occasion, to make a decision. I can't understand any reason why an investigation into that One Observer article, which she then retracted, could possibly have taken a year.
Yeah, and they keep saying it was an independent process, but it's one that's been set up by the Labour Party. Yes. And we're told subsequently that it concluded 5 months
ago. Well, and this is the other point, right? So not only are decisions taking a long time, maybe that one wasn't specifically Starmer's fault, but certainly there's something going on in the Labour Party where it's taking too long to reach important decisions, whether on policy or personnel. But also, while that process is playing out, I've noticed Keir Starmer has a tendency, frankly, not to tell the truth about where it's at. So I remember during the whole debacle over the Green Prosperity Plan, the £28 billion spending plan, Keir Starmer was going out there insisting that Labour remained committed to it, even at the point when we knew he had actually made the decision to reverse it. Now, on this occasion, he said earlier this week the investigation into Diane Abbott was still ongoing. He talked about an ongoing process. He knew that had finished. Why is he going out there saying that there is an ongoing process?
I think they convinced themselves on technicalities. And in his mind, I mean, I don't have an insight into Keir Starmer's mind, but I imagine he will have thought he was referring to the Labour Party process, you know, what happened next, the fact that they were going to restore the whip and then, you know, give her the opportunity to stand down.
Right.
But rather than the sort of the technical, you know, the question which was being asked was the sort of technical disciplinary process, right? So he answered, surprise, surprise, a politician that answers the question that they wanted to have been asked rather than the one that they were actually asked.
And I think the problem for Starmer as well is if you're going to be Mr. Rules, Mr. Transparency, you're holding yourself to a higher standard than necessarily other politicians will be held to. And so if you're going to do that, you do have to be transparent and not give a politician's answer to a difficult question.
But while today obviously has been a day that Labour has ended up having to talk about something, a story that it didn't necessarily want to, the Tories, in the week-long campaign we've had so far, have been pretty much put in that situation every day, haven't they? Not just that moment when Rishi Sunak announced that the election was happening in the pouring rain. He then goes off to Wales to campaign in a brewery of all places and didn't realise that Wales, of course, hadn't qualified for the Euros football tournament. He then went off to Northern Ireland where he ended up addressing the press in the Titanic Quarter, of all places. And then we had photos of him appearing on the private jet that was jetting him around the country in front of a big exit sign. I mean, these are kind of gaffes that Labour has so far avoided, but my God, the Tories should be avoiding, right?
Yeah, this is kind of basic stuff, isn't it? When you're talking about pictures and locations for events, this will all be planned out. And there are people within those teams specifically whose job it is to make sure, you know, that they don't appear in front of a sign saying exit.
So it was a shaky start, that's for sure. But what happened at the weekend, Kieran?
Yeah, so Friday night I got a message from a contact telling me that Rishi Sunak was planning to spend the day in his constituency on Saturday. Now, that to me was quite extraordinary because
4 days in.
We are 4 days into the campaign. This is the first Saturday. It's usually quite a big campaign day. This is your chance to get into the Sunday papers, to, you know, also to talk to voters while they're not at work and get out and do some big events. And also, let's not forget, his constituency has a 27,000 majority. So either Rishi Sunak's concerned about his own constituency, in which case, oh my goodness, what a result.
Well, the mayor of North Yorkshire ended up being Labour, didn't
right,
they?
That is true. Or, as we reported, he was planning to have what I think others called a day off, where I said was a low-key day, retreating largely from the campaign trail. So we reported this on Friday night. The Conservatives got very angry about this, I should say, said it was absolutely not true. One of the reasons the Tories were so furious is it kind of kicked off this narrative of Sunak being lazy. Now, we all in Westminster know that Rishi Sunak is not a lazy man. He's incredibly hardworking. But on the campaign trail, it seems that, you know, at that key moment, he went missing in action. And so the Labour started talking about, you know, Sunak taking a break, taking a day off, being lazy. That really needled the Conservatives. They then hit back. In the last few days, they've been desperate to talk about sleepy Keir, a very Trumpian phrase, trying to highlight Keir Starmer's age. He's 61. He's obviously a fair bit older than Rishi Sunak.
And 20 years younger than Joe Biden, of course.
Well, yeah.
Attack
and,
is leveled
and
that
looks
by
20 years younger than Joe Biden.
Plays five sides,
you know. He's still fairly sprightly. But it's very funny, you know. Actually, what both parties are doing is trying to make an attack, personal attack on the other on the other party's leader that isn't quite resonating yet, because I don't think anybody really thinks Rishi Sunak's lazy. I don't think anybody thinks.
When are we going to see the press up challenge, though? I bet we're going to see that at some point.
Oh my God, I just don't. I can't bear thinking about that.
So, what was going on, really?
First of all, they'd had this very bad start to the campaign, and I think this was just a moment to pause and to think about what they were going to do next. I was told by one source that this was a reset and that the campaign was going to change afterwards. I actually think that maybe what was happening there is, of course, the next day we then had this announcement about the national service policy that
has gone down brilliantly.
That has gone down.
Well, it's popular
been a mixed
amongst
reception.
Core voters.
Yeah, I think, you know, there is a reason to unveil it, and it will have gone down well among exactly the voters it's targeting. But it was interesting to me that they would have had to take a day off to figure out this policy on the first Saturday of the campaign. And that suggests that policy is slightly being made up on the hoof here. Now, I'm sure in Rishi Sunak's brain, he would have had this in his mind for a while. But part of the problem with only having had a small circle of people that he could have discussed the campaign with is that they just weren't properly set up to make these big announcements that we're told they're going to be making throughout the whole election.
And the problem with that particular announcement, of course, was that because his own MPs hadn't been briefed, quite a lot of them kicked off about it and were saying things like, surely our focus should be on our already stretched armed forces and, you know, sorting out their accommodation and their support rather than making them responsible for, you know, however many 100,000 18-year-olds would be heading their way. And there was all sorts of flaws in the policy, which...
Well,
which
what are you going to do in Northern Ireland? Which is the point Steve Baker was making as well.
From his sun lounger in Greece, as it then turned
out.
Another problem for the Prime Minister, getting his MPs up and out and campaigning, it seems like. But one thing I've noticed, which I think is quite striking, is that so far the Tories have announced several bits of policy,
right,
quite sort of eye-catching.
Yep.
There was the National Service announcement that you mentioned for 18-year-olds, which is either doing a sort of a military route for the minority, I think, or doing one weekend a month volunteering for a year, sort of more civic service. There was the pension triple up plus for the Tories to be able to say that pensioners were keeping more of their state pension. And then, of course, there is the latest today, the scrapping of poor quality, what they call Mickey Mouse, university courses and creating thousands of apprenticeships. So these are all quite big policy announcements, whether or not the Conservative Party, the MPs, knew about them or buy into them. And then you contrast that with Labour. I mean, fair enough, Labour were sort of caught on the hop, if you like most of us, maybe take a little bit longer to get the gears going. We've had just really a couple of things. National Security Review in the first 100 days of a Labour government, which sort of was announced as part of an interview. And then this announcement today about the NHS waiting list tackling the backlog within the first 5 years of government, which is not a new announcement per se. It is fleshing out the detail on an existing one. And it makes me wonder whether we're going to see an election where the Tories are sort of lobbing out ever more eye-catching policies in order to get some traction, because, frankly, not much else is going in their favour. And Labour are maintaining that very sort of cautious, careful approach because they don't want to be accused of making announcements for things that they can't then deliver on, as of course happened in 2019 when they announced these very popular policies of free broadband for all and privatising utilities, but nobody believed that they could actually do them.
Yeah, well, this is a decision Labour made a little while ago, and there was the now famous slideshow that Morgan McSweeney, Keir Starmer's strategy chief, gave to the shadow cabinet around the turn of the year, which we reported on, where he showed it was around a dozen elections from around the world that have happened recently where the party that was clearly in the lead going into the campaign have then collapsed during the campaign. And in many of those cases, he told shadow ministers, the reason for that collapse had been there had been some eye-catching policy that had blown up. Now, in recent British history, this is most obviously true in 2017, where Theresa May completely blew up her own campaign by announcing a social care policy that actually, you know, has got a lot of plaudits in terms of policy since, but was massively unpopular. And then she then tried to reverse it while also simultaneously claiming that nothing had changed. So this was a complete disaster for the Tories. But the reason they had done that in the first place was because they felt that their lead was so strong that this was the time to tackle one of the thorniest issues in British politics, something that nobody had been able to solve for decades and decades and decades. And what Labour is absolutely terrified of is trying to do exactly that, using their huge lead in the polls to then do stuff and promise stuff that they've always wanted. The risk of it is that every day you're going to wake up to newspapers and broadcasters covering the Tory campaign, because it's the Tories who are going to dominate the headlines. If they've got all the policies and Labour's trying to say nothing about anything, then the people making the weather, the people framing this election, are going to be the Conservatives and not Labour. All right, so moving from one party that is trying to win an election by not being the Tories to another, or at least trying to win seats by not being the Tories, the Lib Dems. So the Lib Dems this time around, I find it equally plausible that they could win 20 seats or 50 seats. It feels like a huge range of possibilities there for them at this election. And part of that will obviously depend on how much people vote tactically. Do you feel this time around they're better organised than they were last time?
Absolutely. I mean, 2019 was not a great result for them. And on that, I actually have a quote for you, Kieran.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Your favourite moment of the podcast.
I'm in.
For you to guess who, I've probably given it away, but to guess who this might have been that said this. Don't let anyone tell you what has to happen, Kieran. Change is possible. They didn't say Kieran, by the way. Change is possible, and you get to choose. I never thought I'd stand here and say that I'm a candidate to be Prime Minister.
Yeah, I know. Who the last few words. Well, at first I was thinking, well, maybe that's Nick Clegg. That sounds like his soaring rhetoric from 2010. But no, that's the Lib Dem promising to be Prime Minister was Jo Swinson.
In 2019, of course.
Incredible campaign.
And so the difference between that campaign and this so far is that in that campaign, the Lib Dems gained 1 million votes, but in the so-called wrong places. So it wasn't a very efficient vote. They were spread right across the country, which means that they didn't win seats, and they ended up with, despite all the briefings that Joe Swinson would be Prime Minister and they'd, or at least certainly hold the balance of power in a hung parliament, and they'd win 100 plus seats, they ended up getting 11. So this time round, they've been much more realistic about their prospects, and they're prioritising, I'd say, up to 80 seats where they think that they have a chance. But I think that the expectation is that if they win fewer than 30 seats, then it's pretty bad news. And anything more than 40 is actually a really, really good day. So that's kind of like the ballpark that they're looking at. By being much more efficient about looking at places where not just the blue wall, where they can come second to the Conservatives and they can take some seats there, but also looking at local polling and local campaigns, crucially. If they have a very effective local campaign where they get the activists out, they're diverting money into those places as a priority. And that list, that target list, is shifting the whole time. So it's not fixed. It depends on which seats look most winnable on any given day. I think on the flip side, there are still, and we're early in the campaign, right? We're only a week in, we've got 5 weeks to go, but we still don't know much about Lib Dem policy. And that's been a criticism of Ed Davey and his leadership from within the party over some time, that he both dropped that sort of flagship policy the Lib Dems had for ages of 1p on income tax to fund health and social care. And he's also refused to say if the Lib Dems want to rejoin the EU, both of which were considered, you know, flagship Lib Dem policies. And opinion split in the party, particularly about that rejoining the EU question, as to whether it would end up attracting Conservative voters but could risk putting off Remainery Labour voters in other seats that they need to win to get, you know, to push the Tories out. But what we know is that more generally the Lib Dems want to be seen as a party of the NHS or a party of the NHS. They want to focus on cost of living, and we've heard a lot about them on the environment, not least obviously the first event of their campaign with Ed Davey earlier this week.
Falling off the paddleboard.
Deliberately? What do you reckon?
I think if I got off a paddleboard, I would also fall off. So
yeah,
it doesn't surprise
I thought it looked
me.
Quite staged. I mean, not that that's a bad thing. That's how they get the front pages that we were all like tweeting about, the picture.
The Dems are famous for their picture stunts, right? I mean, every time there was a local election, Ed Davey would appear in front of a tractor or something.
It's also about dinosaurs at the local elections this time around. Blue dinosaurs, I think they had. Something like that. Anyway, they're certainly eye-catching.
But yes, you're right. And they're good at catching people's attention when it might not otherwise be focused on them. The question I have is, do they need to have a big policy platform? Or are they actually going to do quite well just by not being the Tories in seats where they've always historically come second? Because I think people are very good at tactical voting. I think it'll play a large part of this election. And I feel this feels... You know, the electorate feels more 97-ish than it does 2019-ish, where there might not be a load of enthusiasm about the Lib Dems, but, you know, you just choose the party that's not the Tories.
And it is always the case that when Labour does well at a general election, the Lib Dems also do well.
But next week, we're going to be dominated but by an event that Ed Davey is not at, which is the leadership debate. We've just had it announced that Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer are going to take part in an hour-long TV debate, 9 p.m. on Tuesday, June the 4th. It's going to be hosted on ITV by Julie Etchingham, and it's going to take place in front of a live studio audience. Now, we've just been reminiscing about debates gone past, but, you know, one of the interesting things for me is it's just those two, because I remember some debates where it's included a whole host of characters, and of course there's the famous 2010 debates where Nick Clegg was on the stage and then suddenly the whole election campaign got turned on its head because we all started paying him attention.
And not least because Gordon Brown and David Cameron, his rivals at that point, it was just the three of them there, kept saying, I agree with Nick over so much, which spawned a fairly sort of messy political journalist drinking game that throughout that campaign, wherever anybody said, I agree with Nick, and you're in the pub, you had to down your drink. But no, anyway, we're much more professional than that these days. Obviously, that was a long time ago. So The Guardian will, of course, be at the debate. There's a sort of a spin room that operates sort of in tandem with whatever's going on the screen, where spinners from each of the parties will be desperately trying to convince journalists that, and therefore the public, that their guys just made a great point, that their guys just won the debate, the other guy's been embarrassed by this or got something wrong, and that, you know, ultimately that their person, their politician is the victor. Of course, we're long in the tooth enough to know that we can make our minds up ourselves on how these things go.
One thing I think that we're sometimes not good at, and this is true of the political class in general, is figuring out how the overall performance will go down with ordinary voters, with, you know, with the general public. And there's a couple of things that I remember, a couple of times I remember when I've covered debates where I was convinced that one person had won or that, you know, that a certain thing had happened in the room. And then just over the coming days, it clearly the feeling of that had changed. One was the Nick Clegg, Nigel Farage pre-Brexit debate, where actually we felt in the room that it had been fairly even, but we thought probably Clegg had managed to land a couple of blows on Farage where Farage hadn't been across the detail, and that big questions were being asked about the Brexiteers' position that hadn't been asked before. And anyway, over the subsequent days, it, you know, if you looked at the polling, actually, it was clear that Farage had come across much better to voters than Clegg had. And in fact, Clegg had been seen as quite pernickety about the detail instead of doing the kind of great sweep and the vision and the narrative that Farage is very good at.
And I've got another much more recent from the 2019 general election campaign. What often happens at these debates is that a pollster will do a snap poll straight afterwards of viewers to see who won, in quotation marks. And one of the debates that time around, there was only a couple of head-to-heads between Jeremy Corbyn and Boris Johnson. And one of the debates, Jeremy Corbyn won, although, of course, went on to historic election defeat afterwards. And there was a moment, if you remember, the election was just before Christmas, and there was a fun question, a trick question, depending on which way you looked at it at the end, about what they'd leave under each other's trees that year.
Right.
And Jeremy Corbyn said that he'd get Boris Johnson a copy of Charles Dickens's A Christmas Carol so he could then understand how nasty Scrooge was.
Okay.
And first of all, Boris Johnson, I mean, he likes having his cake and eating it, as we know. He offered up his Brexit deal, first of all, as a good read. But then he was told, no, your answer has to be non-political. So he changed his answer to some damson jam, which obviously went down well with allotment owner Jeremy Corbyn.
Yeah, there are always those moments, aren't there? I remember one image of Ed Miliband standing in the 2015 election, standing at his debating podium while a group of other party leaders who all happened to be women embraced each other following the debate. And that image then just resonated with people afterwards. So I guess one of the things we'll be looking out for is those images that suddenly sum up the entire campaign.
Well, that's it from us. Please like and follow Politics Weekly UK to make sure you keep getting our episodes in your feed. John Harris is back on Thursday. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby, music by Axel Cocoutier. The executive producer is Maz Ebtahaj. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
This is The Guardian.